behind times, and we're already a few minutes behind, so we should get started, I think, now. This panel is entitled Toward a Sexual Ethic, and I'm Mike Lambert, and I was asked to moderate this panel. I'm a professor of psychology at Brigham Young University, and I have an interest in sex, as most people do. I disguise mine under a professional cloak. As I understand it, the background for this particular panel is that the B.H. Roberts Society had an evening lecture last winter, and a group of... in this lecture, a group of experts got together and discussed the topic Latter-day Saints and sexuality. And there were a number of questions raised at that meeting that were unanswered, and I think among the unanswered questions were had to do with sexual ethics and decisions of personal morality. And so this panel is a kind of outgrowth of that earlier lecture, which is bringing together people who are not experts in this in the area of sex and sexual disorders, as the psychologists and I think there were sex therapists who were believing Mormons at the B.H. Roberts Society, but rather individuals who don't have credentials in this area, but who have given some considerable thought to sexual ethics. The panel then was asked or given a list of questions by one of the panel members, Randy Paul. These questions had to do with such things as what about our eternal nature is sexual? Have we always and will we always be boys and girls? If so, what difference is there between male and female gods? Is the perfect sexual nature an androgynous or a Clark Gable, Marilyn Monroe combination? What's the moral difference between an open marriage and a strict monogamy in the sort of view of polygamy and its eternal, the eternal possibility of polygamy? How do we struggle with these sort of questions of right and wrong in our own sexual behavior? So these and a number of other questions were given to the panel members, and then they chose whether they would deal with these specific questions or whether they would deal with their own questions. And the way our format that we've chosen would be for each panel member to take about 10 minutes. And I will time that, and if that's all right with the panel. And remind them to keep on time. And then we will have a few minutes of interaction between the panel members, and we'll try to move this podium back and the chairs forward so everyone can see the panel talking to each other. And then that should leave us 15 or 20 minutes to have interaction with the audience. And so that's what we'll deal with. I was lucky enough, I suppose, not to have to talk about sex in the sense of giving my own personal opinions about it, but I did like one of the questions that was asked the panel, and it touched off a memory. The question was, why is our sexual behavior so relatively important compared with most other behavior? And then a couple of quotes followed. I would rather my child return to me in a pine box than come home unclean. And another one, adultery is next to murder in seriousness. And so in relation to that question about the importance of sexual behavior, and immediately touched off a memory in my life. I brought up in a Mormon family in a very puritanical atmosphere, and I remember when I was a young boy, we had a female dog, and the dog was in heat. And I didn't know what that was or anything about that at the time, but all I knew is my brother and I were on the chicken coop with our BB guns protecting the dog from these other dogs that were coming in the yard doing I didn't know what, but it didn't look right, and I couldn't tell if my dog enjoyed it or not, but it seemed to me that it wasn't a good thing. And it was at that point that my mother decided to have that talk with me about sex and about what's right. And the learning I got at that age that stuck with me, I can't remember the name of my dog, but I can remember very specifically my mother telling me that fornication or sexual intercourse outside of marriage was second only to murder, and that it was almost the same as murder, but just a little bit less of a sin. And so that question certainly resonates with my own personal background in terms of what's right about sex. Well, at that, let me turn it over now to the panel. Our first panelist is Randy Paul, and I will let him, if he doesn't mind, tell you about himself if he chooses. Catherine Foles follows, then Levi Peterson, and then Melody Lambert.
Warn anybody who doesn't want to either make a contribution to Sunstone financially or be put through something like this, not to ever sit down with Peggy Fletcher and have a serious discussion, because it's happened to me various times. But I'm glad to be here. My wife and I and five kids live in Phoenix, Arizona. Right now we're trying to develop commercial real estate down there and be as good as we can in our lives. I should be attending the concurrent seminar on business ethics, which is in the other room probably, but anyhow. I'd like to start today by simply giving you a couple of primitive assumptions that I will not defend. I'll just tell you what I think. First of all, I think that Joseph Smith revealed the key to an East-West religious detente by describing all that exists as matter. And he, in that sense, put together, I think, monism and pluralism in Mormonism, and this yin-yang thing of female and male also, as the opposition in all things, somehow, to me, has made more sense looking at the basis of this sexual discussion today. Based on that very fact that there is no such thing as spiritual or temporal, but only different organizations of the same stuff. One happens to be a permanent organization that we call people. Another primitive assumption, that there's no real difference between pleasure, happiness, or joy. That the main thing wrong with hedonism is its incredibly limited menu. And the only way that we can think about these kinds of subjects is not try to categorize separately joy from happiness or pleasure. Another assumption is that we and God are co-eternal. Neither of us were ever created, and that we are all, if you will, of the same race. We are not androgynous beings, but part of our eternal nature is a sexuality. In response to that question, I'll blow the cover and say, yes, we were always boys and girls and always will be, but that is somehow something that, along with our individual awareness of our identity and our free will, is part of whatever we call the primal intelligence of man and woman. Another assumption would be that the fundamental sexual characteristics that are eternal are some form of reproduction and an aesthetic difference, to use the term perhaps broadly, and that there can be, of course, as with most aesthetics, I think in heaven, aesthetics, again, with this monism and pluralism, I think the enjoyment that we get from sexual things will perhaps differ. There will be no blondes who have more fun in heaven. Everyone will have their own differences, and and will enjoy what they are ultimately in that final state. But these differences will be forever somehow part of our eternal natures. Okay, with that as a background, let me try to read this paper. That says more than what it really is. But God by nature desires the deepest of friendships. He does not want to be a perfect hermit. To fulfill himself, he works at making friends. His work is raising peers that he can fully enjoy, know as he is known, not pets that he fondly observes. As part of God's fundamental self, his sexual nature craves fulfillment. And through sexual intercourse, he / she, we believe both male and female are gods, enjoy the ultimate unity of heaven, where two experience unified oneness in what we call eternal marriage. Sexual intercourse in mortality is a type of heavenly reality, a symbol, if you will, a reflection of that reality. It is not merely a physical experience any more than we are merely physical beings. But before we discuss the ethical aspects of our sexual behavior, let's look a little more commonly at what is commonly known in our society as it. Bumper stickers say, "Cowboys do it better." And I guess as part of my thesis today is that we should come away feeling strongly in our hearts and minds that Mormons do it better, even better than cowboys. And to define it will be probably part of everyone's discussion today. Incidentally, the semantics of sexual discussion are interesting. I was once told that Eskimos have 20 words or more to describe snow. They really care about snow. They understand it in detail, the nuances. We have, a couple, sexual intercourse, coitus. These are very clinical terms. And then you go to the other extreme where you have four-letter words. My wife and I have often tried to come up with some vocabulary that can describe it better in all of its nuances and in its wonder. Any of you here would be doing us a great service if you have a vocabulary that you have found satisfactory to describe what I, perhaps as part of my primitive assumptions, assume is not a totally ineffable experience. Onward. It, for most people, seems to be the physical experience of coitus. The common concept is that coitus starts with foreplay of the genitals and ends with a mutual closeness, often called afterglow. Intercourse might well commence, however, in a thought mode first and proceed to touching of the hands and kisses, etc. And I submit that a person who limits sexual intercourse in his concept only to ejaculation or climax, those persons are missing out on some of the joy a broader definition and experience would allow. Now, the problem with a broad latitude to the definition of sexual intercourse is that it has ethical ramifications that are more difficult to define, and it muddles the issue somewhat. And I know some of the panelists are going to discuss that in greater detail today. Nevertheless, a broader definition, I think, rivets our attention to the fact that the ethical aspects of our sexual behavior start at the most superficial or seemingly superficial level of relationships between men and women, as they do perhaps in all relationships. I think that men and women both desire the physical pleasure, the emotional closeness, and the spiritual unity of a sexual relationship. There is no double standard in that regard. I believe that we are ethically required, therefore, to define at the earliest point in a neurotic relationship what it means to hold hands, to kiss, and ultimately to have full intercourse. When both parties disclose their meanings and commitments behind their behaviors, then honest decisions can be made regarding engaging in these sexual relationships. Even though, or maybe because, we are bombarded with sex matters daily, we as a people don't take it seriously enough to make our sexual beliefs clear to each other. Until we do, people will suffer more pain or boredom in tandem with their brief pleasure, and will be missing out on the unifying aspects of the great this great expression of love. Many will ultimately sing with the song, "Is that all there is?" And though some think we have come a long way, baby, we have a long way more to go from Victorianism to true Mormonism when it comes to sexual ethics. Mormon sexual ethics are based on love as commitment between individuals, not just attraction. Committed love is the constant that unifies the sexes and avoids sexual extortion prevalent in many marriages, Mormon and non. This commitment, as with all our religious commitments, is ratified or made serious by an ordinance called marriage. We take these ordinances so seriously that we even do them vicariously for the dead. But just as baptism of water and the Spirit is an ordinance not sufficient for salvation, so marriage is not sufficient for eternal unity. The commitment in marriage must be lived out, thank you, 2 minutes left, I'm going to make it, must be lived out through loving behaviors of all sorts. The most enjoyable of these, I submit, is sexual intercourse, in the broader definition. Though there are plenty of social reasons given for keeping sexual intercourse in the marriage covenant only, it is finally, in my opinion, a function of our faith that says this act, to have its highest meaning to us and God, is reserved for those with whom we have committed to achieve a loving sexual unity. Like taking the sacrament, no matter the condition of our hearts, dilutes the real effects of taking the sacrament appropriately, causing us to think inside that there is really nothing special about taking the sacrament, and thus causing us to lose the great blessings of joy and renewal, so engaging in sexual intercourse outside of committed loving wedlock dilutes our enjoyments of the marriage sexual union from the full experience it can be. Some of you might ask, if all we're talking about is diluting a great thing to a ho-hum thing, why would church leaders in our history say that sexual sin has been alluded to earlier, adultery specifically, but also at times fornication could be included in this, is next to murder in seriousness? I will answer by saying there may be some metaphysical aspects of sexual relations that we just don't comprehend at all. The whole concept of God, a being of multiple consciousness who can both enjoy something and be thinking about something else in all its aspects, is something that is beyond my ability to comprehend. And the unity of the family of God, both male and female, in all its aspects, gets to almost a mystical type of thing that is, in fact, ineffable. But I firmly believe that I don't know whether there is anything more to sexual intercourse than what I have described today. I'm just allowing that there might well be something we don't understand, and that's why God's put such an important aura around it. However, if you won't buy that, aside from that, there is an aspect of the marriage covenant that is so strong, and an affirmation of its importance, that we are in essence saying to our wives and husbands, this commitment I make at marriage, I make to you to combine with you and to try to unify with you. It's so important to me. It's as important as life itself. As I would not take the life of another individual, I will not take the life from our love.
I don't know whether it's intentional or not, but it's very close quarters up here. As I anticipated speaking about the subject of sex, and as I've been thinking about it specifically for this forum, many people have come up to me and said to me, "I can hardly wait until your session." And I finally had someone narrow it down to me saying, "Well, talking about it is great, but when will the lab be?" I was raised in a Mormon home by loving LDS people who were also logical and rational thinking people. I married at what now seems to be a very early age, 22 and a half, and I have 4 children. I have also sought to pursue the traditional raising children as my occupation role. Because of this, and as my children came along, the subject of fidelity and non-premarital engagement in sexual intercourse has been a very real issue for me. The issue really came up with the idea of how do we teach our children? What do we teach our children? And this, combined with the idea of rationality in my upbringing, led me to seek some logical reasons why God would say we shall have no sex except with our legally and lawfully wedded spouses. I've come to feel that God is God because he has more knowledge than we have, a great deal more knowledge than we have given. That is not... that he does not say things, do this because I am God and I say you shall do this. So therefore that leads me to look for reasons why possibly he might say this. I've done a lot of reading, had some, fortunately, access to a magazine which I have enjoyed called Human Sexuality. It's a little bit higher class than Good Housekeeping and Parents Magazine, although they've had some good articles as well, so I don't want to discount them. But I have compiled a file in the hopes that as my children reach adolescence, I will be able to have conversations with them about this. The other thing that I felt strongly about was that if I told my children, do this because God says you do this, then in their adolescent state or their young adult state, at the point at which they are beginning to rebel, if you will, which I consider to be a given, that if they rejected God at that point, that they might reject this idea of having only what I call the one partner concept, one sexual partner, and that they might reject this also, and that might give them to have some regrets later on if they chose to come back to God in the church. And that is a background. I will now share with you my, what you might call, rationalizations for why the one sexual partner in our life concept. The first reason I have come to feel, and possibly the most important, is that the sexual act is an expansion or an extension of a relationship, and only of a relationship with a legal binding commitment already in place before the sexual act, more than just that understood or verbal commitment which people who live together tend to tell us. I think perhaps it's this idea that gives our leaders and general authorities to, and our mutual teachers, etc., to say, at least what was said to me as a girl, save yourself. Save yourself for that one man. And so we all went around saving ourselves and not really knowing exactly what it was we were saving ourselves for. I think that we were saving ourselves for that unique relationship which was to be held above all others. And it's that relationship that was to be punctuated with sexual intercourse. Secondly, if sexual intercourse is an extension, a bonus, an added complementing attraction to marriage, then it is not an act in and of itself. It is not a standalone entity to be compared in various settings and with various partners. But therefore, you're not to have the best on a scale of 1 to 10, but only the best within that relationship. It becomes then a facet of a manifold relationship between a man and a woman. A little bit, I have used a diamond metaphor to characterize this relationship, and I don't mean to downplay its importance as deciding who's going to take out the garbage, things like that, but it is still one facet of that relationship. And therefore, it is unique, and it cannot be removed and tried out in other settings. Thirdly, sex derives its emotional input from the relationship of which it is a part. Sex without emotion, the idea that it is a pleasurable act, why can we not experience this pleasurable act with someone else where I agree, my husband agrees, it's pleasurable, it's not hurting anyone, is therefore impossible. It also possible to have sex
with emotion, but because of the fact that there is ego and identity involved that are coming into the sexual act, even outside of the marital relationship, it is never sex totally void of emotion. Fourthly, there are many ways of communicating in a relationship. When the verbal communication moves into the area of physical communication, the physical then, it is my experience, and in talking to other people I've found this to be true, becomes all-encompassing. Now within the setting of marriage, this encompassing feature of physical communication becomes enlarging and bonding because we have that constant, regular, secure contact with each other. However, outside marriage, where the contact is not so secure, the physical plays a much larger part in the relationship, oftentimes replacing other forms of communication. It becomes disproportionately larger, and therefore the relationship is unable to grow. The last point that I wanted to make about this is comes from an article which describes four points of intimacy: communication, affection, trust, and commitment. Extramarital sex violates the intimacy and each one of these points in a marital relationship, therefore becoming destructive to the marital relationship in some ways. Many of these five points, I feel, can also be applied to premarital sexual intercourse when talking with adolescents or children. Now, we have talked specifically as sexual intercourse as defined, as Randy put it, as intromission or coitus or the act itself. He also alluded to the idea of broadening the definition of sexual intercourse, which is something that should be done in marriage and actually enhances the enjoyment. But we find that our general authorities and our church leaders are broadening the definition outside of marriage also, so that anything that could be construed as sexual is being taught as the breaking of chastity. And we're talking now about kissing and petting and even down to lustful looks. We see how Jimmy Carter got in trouble with his lusting in his heart. While it's great in marriage, we are told in the church it is not acceptable outside of marriage. I tend to disagree with this. I feel that it is very important to our teens and people outside of marriage to understand that affectionate activity is part of relationships. And I feel like putting these guilt trips on our teens and our unmarried adults and homosexuals makes them feel guilty and negates the possibility of having intimacy, the intimacy of friendship, without the sex act. Because of this coming out of the church, of this broadening definition of sexual intercourse, everyone is asking for lines to be drawn. They ask the leaders, what is okay, what is not okay. They want specific answers as to what they can do. And I would propose that what we need to do and what we need to teach our adolescents is to take the responsibility for the lines themselves. And perhaps a guideline would be that when the caring and loving aspects of affection have left off and the erotic aspects of affection have become prevalent, that's where the line should be drawn. And I think lines are different for everyone. From reading and from other sources, thank you, I have been convinced that touching is very important in our lives for emotional security. I would like now for everyone to reach out and touch the person closest to you. This is the last part of this session that was from. Perhaps you can tell a little something about your own sexuality by judging how it was that you touched the person next to you. How it depended, obviously, on how well you knew them. Did you hold their hand? Did you touch their skin? Did you merely touch their sleeve? This will give you an idea about a little bit about where you are in regards to touching. I feel that the church has really put touching in a bad light, that touching is taboo. And I've begun to feel this even more and more when you begin to have non-LDS relationships in which touching is a very infinite part as you begin to grow to love and care about another person outside of the church. I feel much more comfortable hugging or holding hands than I would be if I were to do the same with the same kind of a feeling for a member of the church. And I think this comes from the fact that the church leads us to believe that touching is part of sexual intercourse and therefore wrong. Just quickly, since my time is up, I would like to comment on one further aspect of sexuality, and that is the ethics of sex in marriage. Now, we have a sort of a gateway idea about sex in marriage. We come to marriage, two chaste Mormon people knowing nothing about sex. It's a giant concrete wall. Suddenly the gate is thrown open, and we are bombarded by everything that is available to us, and how do we cope with this? I would like to indicate that I feel that the number one thing that should be done is talking. I have now gotten a book called Connective Bargaining. It's all about talking about sex, talking before marriage especially. People say, I must live with this person to see if I'm sexually compatible. I maintain that if you will talk about it, express your feelings, which Randy has also said, that you will find out whether or not you are sexually compatible without the physical experimentation. The most important thing that we can do in our marriages, we talk about it's okay. I must live with this person to see if I'm sexually compatible. I maintain that if you will talk about it, express your feelings, which Randy has also said, that you will find out whether or not you are sexually compatible without the physical experimentation. The most important thing that we can do in our marriages, we talk about it's okay if you both agree. Well, you can't agree unless you talk about it. Thinking and talking before the gate opens makes the opening of that gate an exciting, exhilarating experience that you are anticipating greatly, rather than the intimidating or frightening experience that it so often is. And I think that, if I could say, it's disappointing perhaps to some. Someone who has never been allowed to have candy will tend to OD on candy rather than just sample it and take for whatever is pleasurable. May I leave you with a picture of the marital relationship as the many-faceted diamond, each one different, not being able to be duplicated, and about sex as being a very important part of that, a very important facet of that diamond. Thank you.
I think that it has its inhibitions. They're inherited. They're Christian, and they're not single to Mormonism either. The Christian tradition is one of repression, sexual repression. I expect that in about 100 years, really, the church will be much more liberalized regarding sex. It will take a while, but it'll happen. I really expect it'll happen.
I would just respond, and maybe we use this a lot to rationalize that. That I once was told that if you ask Marky Peterson how often sexual intercourse should be had between married people, he said once a week. Any more than once a week is an imposition on the wife. And Paul Dunn said that's directly related to his age. And I feel like in response to this man that the edict that came out from the church is also directly related to the age of the general authorities. And as we heard in the human sexuality yesterday, the same is true of masturbation, that they are responding today in a non-clinical way to the way clinicians were responding to masturbation 50, 60 years ago when they were in their young adult period of their lives.
I disagree. I feel that, you know, when we're in this gray area of what's revelation, what's culturally or age-induced communication, that I have found it always safer to assume that there's some reason for that craziness, and that what to me that seems crazy might indeed have some basis. And I've been grappling, of course, with questions that we all grapple with today, and I'm reserving judgment. I disagree with Levi, the church will, quote, liberalize, that God will change his directives to us on major issues such as adultery and homosexuality, and even to a certain extent masturbation. I think that the whole concept will perhaps come out as a second best or a lesser evil. I think the church has taken a position now that it's a minor indiscretion. And I know they reversed, or someone came out with a letter subsequent to the 82 letter where they said to the bishops that stay out of the bedroom effectively. That's no longer part of the interview process. So,
that didn't change the meaning of the first letter, though.
Yes, it did.
I believe it did.
To me as a bishop.
Yes, I believe it did to me, the way I read that.
The second letter told them to pay better attention to the first letter.
Well, in the spirit of the thing to me is that the brethren are asking questions. They're asking the Lord. They're asking themselves. They're trying to come to conclusions on these nitty-gritty questions that we're all trying to discuss today. And I take the opposite point, not the opposite, but a different point of view, that I think we might well find that sodomy is actually wrong, that homosexuality is actually bad, that masturbation can be avoided, and that it's better perhaps not to engage in it. I believe these things are all possibilities. My wife's in the audience. I would imagine if you were to be honest, your sexual attraction for me wanes frequently, and it goes up maybe from time to time. And I'm not trying to make light of a chronic or serious problem. I've just found that in my life, to respond honestly, I think that the marriage relationship is not one of feeling. It can be, and the lucky ones have it. And I think ultimately it will be when all things are made right in the resurrection. But I think that the fundamental marriage is a marriage of commitment, and that will somehow, if we keep that commitment of love and unselfishness, will see us through. We might get, I have a friend who tells me that he goes from island to island of emotional happiness. But most of his marriage is not emotionally happy. And yet, he feels he's doing the right thing, and his wife does, in creating as much of that happiness as they can. I don't think that's wrong. I think that's the position.
Well, my thought about that is that maybe that sort of question is a question that really can't be answered in a general way, and that maybe it's not even a good idea to try to answer it, but it may be.
What about sex therapy? The Gentiles go to sex therapists.
That's probably a good idea.
Is that the issue?
Yeah.
Maybe there's not enough.
So I don't know if you're going to try to answer this question, because I would rather turn the conversation towards struggling with ethics, struggling with the ethics of personal choice.
I was just going to say that, to reiterate what I tried to say in my remarks, and that is the talking about it, not only just between the husband and wife, but then seeking, if you're embarrassed and you don't want to go to sex therapist, any kind of a therapist who will get the conversation going. And I think this is true of any problem. We had a psychologist tell us one time that that psychologists will usually ask a couple when they approach them for family counseling about their sex life. She said, "You may think we get our jollies out of hearing about people's sex lives." She said, "That's not true at all. We can usually tell by how well the communication is regarding the sex itself. Do they talk during sex? Do they say, as the sex therapist said, you would say in a back rub, scratch a little higher and over to the right? Do we say that in sex, or are we embarrassed to say that, even with our marital companions? If you can open up this kind of a dialogue, some of these things maybe then can be worked out."
Yes.
Let's see who is first.
Go ahead.
I have one comment. Therapy is no substitute for imagination.
That's a good statement.
I think instead of going to a therapist and spending your life savings, you might just cultivate some imagination.
Read a book.
Enjoy.
Yeah. Okay.
I just want
going to make two responses. One, I think that what you said that you did initially is an example of what I commented on before. Your love for those young people overcame your fears or inhibitions about talking about sex, and I think that's very admirable. Another comment I have about the things that have been said here in general, and I don't mean this to sound simplistic, but I do not see a church authority as the final authority. I have a very profound and meaningful relationship myself with God, my Heavenly Father and my Heavenly Mother, and I think we are so set too much now in this idea of we must have an authority tell us what to do. And I don't say that to denigrate or disregard what any well-meaning leader, male or female, does. I think that's absolutely necessary, but to overlook our own abilities and to overlook the goodness that can come from talking about these things with one another, and to think we only have to go to sex therapists or only have to go to a church authority, I think that we are not taking advantage of all of our resources.
Spirit will probe that person to come forth rather than probe specifically. But I don't know what the youth interviews state. Can anyone give us some enlightenment on that? Was that bishop wrong in that he did not follow the instruction? Or was he overstepping his instructions? I'm asking the bishops from what is the program? Does anyone know? What do they tell the bishops to do? I don't know.
I don't think bishops ought to be poking around with that anyway in any way with that. I can't believe that the superintendent of this vast cosmos gives a damn about a boy masturbating or a girl masturbating. I think what he cares about is the purposefulness and the well-being and the integrity of that individual. And if masturbation happens to fit into those, he's contented or she's contented. God is contented. I think that we are a terribly commandment-oriented bunch of people. We're a childish bunch of people. We want God to tell us whether sodomy is good or bad. We'll ask ourselves if it's good or bad. If for most of us it's bad, it's bad. Leave it alone. If some people find it fulfilling and happy, well, don't knock it. Let them have it. Let them do it. Don't ask about it in your bishop's interview.
I think they practice oral sex.
It seems to me an issue that comes up over and over again that's not very specific to the things, but is a general thing, is the extent to which people look to religious authority and weight that in their decision about sexual practices and to what extent people look at their own experiencing or other kinds of authority figures. That
I have been a mission president. I have interviewed hundreds of missionaries over a 3-year period. I have had missionaries come clear across the country to describe to me the misery they felt with the problem they have with masturbation. I can tell you that masturbation robs missionaries of their spirituality, and that in many cases, missionaries who had it would have given anything if they had it like before they came into the mission field. And those that did make it in the mission field found a sense of achievement and pride that strengthened their spirituality for the rest of their mission and sent them home much happier.
done work on them, and yeah.
You're going to reject my solution. My solution is that I suggested that sexual expression is appropriate for all human beings. I personally believe in marriage because I think the rewards of marriage are worth the restraints. The sense of loyalty and intimacy that comes in marriage it's worth sexual fidelity. And I don't think you can have marriage without sexual fidelity. But for people who are committed single people, I think sexuality ought to be a permissible thing. I believe that people who see themselves as permanently single should be accepted that they can seek out sexual expression with the people they're attracted to. If they're heterosexual, then with people of the opposite sex. If they're homosexual, then with members of their own sex. That's where I stand on it, and I think the church will head that direction eventually. Well, I think you yourself define it. When somebody stands up and says, what do we do about sexual relations for the singles? They're saying there is such a thing. You yourself define it. If you're still headed toward marriage, you're 15, you're still headed toward marriage, well, keep saving yourself. I'm for it. that's acceptable to me. But if you're 25 and you've decided you're never going to marry, then I assume you can define yourself as single, and I say, well, then make your own arrangements.
I don't know whether she is saying that we as a panel were advocating feast or famine. Is that what you got?
No, I was wondering what your practical solution would be for someone who maybe wanted to stay within the LDS moral code and yet avoid the harm of feast and famine.
I think that this is a very good question, and this is what people are constantly asking, and what I tried to say was that they want us to draw specific lines. It's just like the little black book where you look up, is petting okay, yes or no? And what I tried to say was that I think it's different for everybody, and there may be some absolutes. I personally would believe that oral sex would be an absolute erotic act. There's no way that could be affectionate between friends. But if you cut off total affection, any kind of affection at all, or any kind of exploring as to where the affection ends and the eroticism begins, then you've got the feast or famine idea, and so the line has to be drawn, and there may be some people who simply cannot touch another person to whom they are sexually attracted without having that erotic feeling. I don't know. Personally, I enjoyed a lot of affection before it got to the point of eroticism, and I felt like that was very helpful at the point at which I got married. And I also experienced with my sister who got married and had not had those experiences that she taught. Her wedding night was similar to what you're describing, this idea of rape or lack of knowledge or whatever. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
I think we're assuming that all single people have relationships with someone, friends, and I don't know the number of single people you know, but I know many, many, many who never date, who have no relationships, though they want them. It is simply a fact that they do not, for various reasons. And so some of the things that you've heard that I think are right, but the opportunity isn't there. And the opportunity, as I said before, if all I want is sex, it's available. It's available from LDS men, married and non-married. It's available from almost any, a man in any walk of life. Let me put it that way. Not any man, but a man in any walk of life. I don't know the answer for you other than I think to deny sexuality is something I am unwilling to do. I don't have very many good role models of single women or single men who have maintained a healthy sexuality past a certain age. I find them defensive, or I find them hiding in almost a neuter attitude.
Well, there is no sexuality for a single person, is there? Really?
No, you're right. That is basically how it comes. And I think that you have to be, anyone who tells you, let me put it this way, anyone who tells me that non-sexual affection will satisfy my need to express or accept sexual affection, they're wrong. Those are two different things. They are equally good and equally important, and I find great pleasure in holding and kissing and touching my nieces and nephews, my family, hugs, things like that, but it is not the same as a sexual expression. And to stay within the boundaries of the church, you face the fact that for almost all intents and purposes, you have very limited sexual expression if you remain single through your life.
So maybe the answer is that the person does have to choose between membership in the church and the sexual.
Why not life change is what I say. Why not change? It's barbaric.
I don't know how to relate better than we as Mormons, and I think that's really true, because I was brought up in an era where it was either all or nothing, and I was taught that, and it's still around, you stay away from women unless it's your own wife. And I think there's a great deal of social interaction because of our lack of understanding. Because, you know, your wife might have a bomb, don't go near a woman because you're going to get in trouble. And we're in a real social vacuum in that sense, and we don't know how to relate with each other. Because we're so afraid of sex. We think if you get close, it's gone. And we need a lot more of that interaction. Other people know how to do that much better than we
do. I have one comment here, one there, and then we'll that be it.
I'm hearing sexuality is an ethic only in the act of deep intimacy between two or more people. And I think that we're touching on the important standards that we need to consider in the overall ethics of how I fit into my church and the different levels of spouses and mores. The fact that our Heavenly Father made us sexual beings, and that make up sexual beings not just a deep intimacy, which I call the main fulfilling mating instinct. Sexuality is important the way our Heavenly Father made us. Our sexual being is made up of all of those physical, emotional, imaginative, physical things in life. Music, portrait, the pleasantness of being in a social setting with people, the good feeling I have being close to friends. That's all part of our sexual being. It's part of our physical, spiritual, emotional makeup that makes life pleasant for us. And I've heard messages from my church that say, from the text, that Paul, it says, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are good, whatever things are pure, think on these things. That's put in the setting of deep intimacy of fulfilling mating instinct, it's just we're obsessed with sexuality, you know. But I think if we could spread that sexual feeling around, and actually around, and get romance in this thing. Candlelight, good music, poetry, the feeling of the liking to be around people, this will do a lot of your sexual and ease it off that need to fulfill mating instinct. I think fulfilling mating instinct is part of the discipline of a truly ethical person who is well rounded, made in the image of the Heavenly Father, to function in all the levels possible of that person's
personality structure to be a fulfilled, happy, in control human being, enjoying everyone, and then having that sort of empathy and proper life experience.
There's somebody on the, would you like to make a nice comment?
I was commenting on what the gentleman over here was saying. As far as fear goes, and I'm Norma Gita, not so long ago I was a Mormon youth, and I was at BYU, and I loved to dance, and I was a dance maker at the time. And I danced a lot with lots of different guys, and I loved every bit of it. And then I got married. Get anybody to ask me to dance. They were so scared of coming here, a married woman, that I couldn't dance anymore. And that is a practical effect of what the teachings of the church have often instilled in young people. And I don't agree with that.
Thank you. Maybe on behalf of the audience. I know I'd like to thank the people in the audience for participating. Maybe that last comment's a part of the message of the panel, which is let's keep dancing.
And you're saying clearly, thank you.